Yeah, Jackie's just outside. She'll be right here.
Okay. Call to order the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety. Today is April 1st, 2015, and we're convened for the purposes of a public hearing on Senate Bill 5531, the budget bill of the Oregon State Police. Julie, anything you want to tee up for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, we are here to continue hearing from the Oregon State Police on their budget, and we will continue today with the Patrol Services Division and Captain David Anderson.
Captain Anderson, please proceed.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Shields, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Anderson, and I am a captain with the Oregon State Police Patrol Division, and I will be giving an overview of the division. I know we are pressed for time today. I have a lot of presentations behind me, so I'll move through this quickly, but of course be happy to answer any questions. The Patrol Division contributes to the agency mission by patrolling over 6,400 miles of rural and interstate highway. We also protect state property, as well as a combined 254 rest areas and state parks. Our priorities for the division are traffic enforcement, apprehension of persons involved in criminal activity, crash investigation, response to calls for service. In fact, in 2014, our division responded to nearly 187,000 calls for service. We also render aid to citizens in need. In 2014, again, we had just under 28,000 motorist assists and received just under 42,000 driving complaints from the public. We also provide assistance to other law enforcement agencies. Our dispatch recorded in 2014 nearly 16,000 outside law enforcement agency assists performed by the Oregon State Police. Operational efficiencies and successes. In 2013, we saw a 15% reduction in the number of fatal crashes as compared to 2012. As you can see, 47% of those fatal crashes involved alcohol and or drugs, whereas 31% involved speed. Those two factors have historically been two of the greatest factors that have led to fatal crashes. We were able to remove over 2,600 DUII offenders from the roadways, likely preventing further crashes, if not fatal crashes, from occurring. You can see our drug seizures for the Patrol Division in 2014. I would just like to add here that one of the greatest assets that we have in combating the illegal trafficking of controlled substances is our canine program. We have 9 authorized positions scattered throughout the state. 8 of those are currently filled, and we're hoping to fill the 9th fairly soon. This unit is not only an asset to our division and agency, but also to other law enforcement throughout the state, both city and county, as they use our unit as requested. I would just like to also point out, got some news earlier this morning, that our newest canine deployed in Central Point within the past couple of weeks had its first deployment last night and uncovered 28.5 pounds of crystal methamphetamine in a car. So again, a representation of how the good work that that unit can do.
Did you reward him properly?
I'm sure he was fed plenty of biscuits, but he is a working dog. So.
Senator Winters.
So continuing.
Just a moment, Senator Winters.
A question, yes, about my favorite subject. What will happen now that with the recreational marijuana?
My question too.
And because their canines are actually trained to sniff out all of the drugs, and so as I understand it, you cannot untrain. And correct me if that's not correct. But so, do we need to make certain that we've got resources to make certain that you can get the dogs that you need? Because I'm a very, very high supporter of canines.
Yes, Co-Chair Shields, Senator Winters. Yes, we've been preparing for this for some time. We reached out to our partners in Washington and Colorado to see how they approach this issue. We also asked the Department of Justice for a legal opinion on how the passage of Measure 91 would affect our canine program. We are going to be providing training to our canine officers prior to July 1. I will say that we have recently purchased 4 new dogs, and none of those dogs are trained on marijuana. They're trained on the 3 other drugs, heroin, cocaine, and methamphetamine, which is similar to what our 2 partner states, Colorado and Washington, have also done. Continuing with efficiencies and successes, Captain Worthy spoke yesterday about the tablet rollout, so I'll move right past that. Our TASER program, we completed rollout by the end of 2012.
Follow-up. Is that adequate, your four new dogs?
We have four new dogs, Co-Chair Shields, Senator Winters, four new dogs. The four remaining dogs are trained on marijuana, and they will be phased out over time. They still have life left in them. And what we're going to be doing is providing training to those officers on what they need to do to overcome the hurdle that is present because those dogs are trained on marijuana.
Yeah, I raise that because it took us a while to get the resources to make certain we had I-84, I-5, and all those corridors. So I just want to be assured that we do have the resources that the canine unit needs in the state. That's the reason for my question.
Co-Chair Shields, Senator Winters, I understand your question, and I agree on the value of that program, and it's very important to us. Continuing with our TASER program, comparing 2011 pre-TASER to 2013 post-TASER rollout, our agency saw a 67% decrease in workers' compensation claims where injuries were sustained due to combative subjects. Moving on to our key performance measures, I'm going to move quickly through this measure as we are proposing it for replacement. We discovered through the Oregon Department of Transportation that there was some underreporting of injury and property damage crashes that actually affect the target on this KPM. The new KPM that we are proposing deals specifically with fatal crashes, with a goal of reducing fatal crashes 25% over a 10-year period. The starting point or the baseline is based on an average between 2008 and 2012 of fatal crashes. And that comes out to the 134 that is represented on the graph. So a 25% reduction from that number over 10 years comes to 101 fatal crashes by 2022. Of course, we would love to have fewer than 101. In fact, zero would be a great number. That would be an excellent goal to have. One other thing that this KPM will do is allow us to examine the effectiveness of our efforts towards evidence-based driving behaviors that lead to fatal crashes. We term those the Fatal Five, and we represent them through the acronym SOLID: speed, occupant safety, lane safety, impaired driving, and distracted driving. The next KPM.
Wait for a second, Senator Bates.
This is an interesting chart, the previous one. So a lot of things that apply here to less fatalities, including safer cars. But you're also up against increasing number of people in the state. Are you trying to adjust this for increasing population and people driving more, or are you just going to flat out try to bring it down?
Co-Chair Shields, Senator Bates, we're going to flat out try and bring it down.
Mm. Follow-up question. And I often see people traveling on I-5 10 miles over the limit, and if you're doing it in Portland, nothing happens to you. You do it in the middle of nowhere, you're likely to get a ticket. And that's just when they're flowing through. But what really worries me is I also see people flowing up down I-5 with their phone in their ear, and maybe they're eating lunch too, I don't know. And that's, I think, more of a danger right now when people tend over the limit. What you're trying to do evidence-based driving issues. You know, if someone's doing 20 over, I think obviously we got a problem. They're weaving out traffic. I really worry about distracted drivers. I think it's going to be a really big thing before we're through. And are you trying to start to really seriously enforce that?
Co-Chair Shields, Senator Bates, yes, we are. This is a definitely an emphasis for our division and our agency. We send out monthly stats provided to our stations, and distracted driving is certainly one of our Fatal Five categories, and cell phone distraction is definitely a big component of that.
Thank you.
So continuing with key performance measure number two, this measures the percentage of calls for service where a trooper is available to respond. This KPM is also slated for replacement or being recommended for replacement. It was linked with Project 200 back in 2009 when we were slated to receive 200 additional positions. That never came to fruition because of budget constraints. The goal, the target for the KPM was to be able to respond to troopers, be available to respond 93.7% of the time. And as you can see, we have never actually reached that target. So we are recommending this for replacement.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Captain, how far are you currently in terms of authorized strength versus number of troopers that you have?
Co-Chair Shields, Representative Gorsuch. So the superintendent mentioned yesterday that our trooper field strength is 334. In the patrol division, currently we have 32 vacancies. Okay. However, we also have a recruit school going on with approximately 47 recruits. Those will not be in the field until this fall, so not serving the citizens. So until that time, we're really working with approximately 70 to 80 vacancies.
Follow-up. And, you know, we've heard from some sections of the state in terms of needing more enforcement. I mean, a lot of sheriff's departments have gone way down. And I'm not interested in the state police doing their functions, but I am concerned about 24/7 service around the state. Is there a budget number that would ensure that that does occur?
Co-Chair Shields, Representative Gorsuch, there likely is, but I do not know what that number would be.
If someone could let me know about that, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
All right, please continue.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Bates.
I want to apologize for whispering back here, but it was for your own good. It was positive. About 7 or 8 years ago, we turned a whole bunch of officers loose. We had to have a fair for them to get jobs again. You lost a lot of your force at that point. We were worried about what would happen when we started rehiring, the cost of rehiring, and the time it would take. I remember there was a job fair up in Portland for it, and Washington came in, and Idaho came in, and local jurisdictions came in and hired away a lot of well-trained officers. And now we're trying to hire back or build back. Are our wages for our state patrol officers sufficient to keep them from going to cities, counties, and other states?
Co-Chair Shields, Senator Bates, we do feel that our wages are competitive. In fact, I believe our troopers, because of a previous, I believe it's called the term, the pay parity bill, are receiving a bump in pay today. And so I think with that change, we are very competitive in the market.
It is April Fool's, so I hope he's telling me the truth here.
And our troopers also hope that. So,
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Krieger.
The department, as we all know, has had a problem since we lost our dedicated funding source. That's the facts. That's where the problem lies. It's our fault. You've had, what, 25, 30 years to do something about dedicated funding? You had a bill, I believe, yesterday in Judiciary. We did. Mm-hmm. Representative Olson, I can't remember who the other one was on the bill, that would take some of the revenue from, from alcohol sales. I don't care. I don't think... There's no partisanship on this issue on this committee. And someone's got to take the lead of saying, hey, we're going to do it. And I think that we need to make that a priority. Then they won't be going up and down. Families won't be disturbed, and we won't be training troopers for everybody else in the nation.
Right.
Thank you. Representative Gorsuch.
To follow up with that, I think Representative Krieger is absolutely right. We have a situation where... we have a lot of holes in our law enforcement protection, especially in rural Oregon. It's unacceptable, and it is up to us to take care of that. We shouldn't be in a position where our state troopers don't have enough cover. We shouldn't be in a situation where there are people who can't get anyone to come to an emergency from a 911 call. I mean, this is like we're back in the 1930s. And so I absolutely support this idea of a mandated authorized strength funding for the state police.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you. So continuing with the proposed replacement KPM, quickly, this involves traffic incident management. This is a nationwide movement, and it measures the percentage of lane blockage blockage crashes that are cleared within 90 minutes. The target of 80% was set through mutual agreement with the Oregon Department of Transportation. There are similar KPMs both in Washington and California that the Highway Patrol or CHP or State Patrol in Washington have with their transportation agencies. Really, the crux of the traffic incident management is about improved efficiency through cooperation and coordination of all emergency responders. Training takes place with tow companies, ODOT, fire, EMS, and all of our patrol division members were trained in 2014 on traffic incident management. Our last KPM details the number of traffic stops that result in a custody arrest or criminal citation. This was also created off of 2008 data, essentially a 10% increase based on 2008 numbers of traffic stops that did result in a custody arrest or criminal citation. You can see that in 2011, we exceeded our target of 2.7%. And then you're probably like me, you're looking at 2013 and wondering what in the world happened. That is not an April Fool's joke. what happened was technology. We upgraded our computer-aided dispatch system on August 13th, 2012. And what this really did was allow us to capture, record, and report traffic stop data in a much more accurate manner. And probably the best way to describe it is an example. Under the old system, if a trooper made a stop and arrested the driver with three criminal charges, the old system recorded that as three separate stops, each with a criminal charge, thus artificially inflating the number of traffic stops that resulted in one of these factors. The new system is able to say one stop with three charges. So as a result, the number of traffic stops that result in these two factors dipped to 0.7% for 2013. As a result, we need a new target. And that new target is based on the same methodology and comes out to 0.8% for 2014. Moving on and down the home stretch, the 15-17 governor's budget, a little over $152 million total funds, 92% general fund, 8% other funds, and that's our contracts with Capital Mall here and Oregon State University mainly. And then under 1% of federal funds, those are our grants to conduct speed OT, DUII, et cetera. And then lastly, our budget drivers, fuel costs, recruit schools, and vacancies. The superintendent touched on this yesterday, but to give you an idea of the depth of the problem, we lose approximately or nearly three sworn members agency-wide and have done so for several years now. So keeping up with that attrition rate is definitely a challenge for us. Unforeseen complex incidents, SWAT call-outs, natural disasters, active shooter incidents, and of course vehicles and improvements in equipment and infrastructure continue to be budget drivers for us. Yes, sir.
Do we have a sense of how much you might spend on, I assume it's gasoline, not diesel, on in a given biennium?
Co-Chair Shields, actually I received a breakdown not long ago from our budget department. I don't recall it at the top of my head. Be more than happy to provide that to you.
Good. If you could email it to the professional staff and they'll distribute it.
We'll do that. Right. Thank you very much.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Kevin, would you go back to the last slide, or slide 31, please?
I will if I can.
Yes. Okay, Mr. Chair. So, Kent, 0% federal and 8% other funds. I was going back and recovering what I didn't see. I wasn't here yesterday. The same thing on the overall budget, that those, the federal funds and other funds are significantly low. Is that a trend? Is that normally we're getting that little bit of federal funds? And if you, I went back, I think the federal funds on your overall budget was 3%. It's 0% here. Is that trending up or down, or is that normal?
Co-Chair Shields, Senator Wisnett, I actually do not know the answer to that off the top of my head, but I can certainly get the historical trend of our budget to you by breakdown.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I mean, we see the other budgets, and it's usually much larger than that federal fund, so is there not enough? Is they're not going to this organization, or is it federal, something we're going to see in the future from federal funding? So I think I'd appreciate that if you chairs agree.
Sure. Senator Winters.
I think it's only when there's some federal grant or things that come down. Generally, this budget has been pretty much general fund supported. Prior to that, of course, it was dedicated funds when we actually had funds from gasoline tax, but it's an anomaly to see a lot of federal funds in this particular budget, but when some special things kind of come down the pike, then you'll see those.
Thank you. And it's Representative Barker's birthday, by the way. Happy birthday.
Thank you. So, Captain, I just wondered, and you don't need to answer today, but if you could let us know. I know there's money comes back from hunting and fishing licenses and ammunition sales and so on. I'm hoping the state police get a piece of that for their game board work. So I just, if you could let me know about that, I appreciate it.
Co-Chair Shields, Representative Barker, Captain Samuels with the Fish and Wildlife Division is the next presenter.
Okay.
He can probably help you out with that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm just asking, Representative Barker, where's the cake?
You had a party at 12:30.
Upstairs, they had a whole big sheet of it.
You didn't invite us.
Yeah.
Not as senators.
We sent out 10.
Well, I got an invite, I guess.
Yeah.
You can read your emails.
He's special.
Oh, Lord.
All right.
Co-Chair Shields and Co-Chair Williamson and committee members, for the record, my name is Jeff Samuels. I'm the captain of the Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division. I guess just to start it off, to answer Representative Barker's question, the Dingell Johnson and Pittman Roberts Federal Act for excise tax on angling gear and shooting supplies does not allow for the use in enforcement.
Oh, okay.
So ODF&W does get those funds and utilizes those funds, but it doesn't come over to the Fish and Wildlife Division for enforcement.
Okay, thank you very much, Captain.
So I will also be brief just because there's lots of other folks behind me that are waiting to get up here as well. But the Fish and Wildlife Division, there's 117 authorized positions, and we enforce the Fish and Wildlife laws. We do so to ensure sustainable fish and wildlife resources and to protect the environment. We have a large patrol area, as you can see. Obviously, it's the state of Oregon, but it's basically all of the land of Oregon, the 100,000 miles of streams, the 6,000 lakes and reservoirs, and then we also patrol the Pacific Ocean up to 200 miles with a federal agreement with National Marine Fisheries Service for federal fisheries. We're also, as the superintendent mentioned, we're state troopers. We do all types of state trooper work. We enforce criminal traffic, ATV, and boating safety laws. I'll go into our priorities quickly. We protect the fish and wildlife resources for future generations. We ensure sustainable commercial fisheries, which are very important to our coastal economics. We protect the environment and our natural resources. We collaborate with Oregon's other natural resource agencies, and in fact, we are the criminal enforcement arm for those agencies. So like Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Division of State Lands, Department of Ag, and many others, DEQ. We provide rural law enforcement services, so we are out and about in our rural areas, in the backcountry, and on the rivers and lakes, and we provide that law enforcement service. So when people call, we're usually there, when oftentimes there's not other law enforcement in that area. And we're also protecting Oregon citizens and visitors while they're engaged in outdoor recreating activity like boating safety and ATV use, that type of thing. I won't dwell on this because the superintendent talked about it and some of the others, but the division did go to body cameras. The body cameras shown there in red with the circle around it, it really has helped us out in documenting our activities.
Representative Williamson.
So with those body cameras, how often do you have them on? What's your policy around them? How does storage work? We're just having these discussions here. I'm not aware of it, and I'd love to hear how you all do it.
Co-Chair Williamson, so all of the Fish and Wildlife Division troopers have that, and they record on enforcement contacts, and then they store that data for, depending on the case, mm-hmm. if it's a criminal case, or there could be some other retention periods, but at least 12 months, like we do with our video cameras from the truck or car-mounted recorder.
So how do you define the contact that requires you to turn on your body camera?
So anytime, Representative Williamson, co-chair, so anytime that we would where it would turn into a contact where there might be a warning or a citation or an arrest, that's when we would do it. Obviously, a lot of our contacts relate to administrative checks of just licenses and people engaged in hunting and fishing activity where it's a fun event for them. They're doing things lawfully, and we're administratively checking their license to make sure that they have one. But to any time that we turn into an enforcement contact, see someone, retaining a fish they weren't supposed to or any of those, we would engage and notify people that we're engaging with a video and go through the process.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Representative Corson.
To follow up on that, Where is the actual data stored? Is it on a computer? Is it on a hard drive sort of system?
Sure.
DVD, things like that.
So co-chairs and Representative Gorsuch. So just like our watch guard, we call them watch guard cameras from the vehicles. We utilize this in a similar way. So it obviously records onto a SD card on the camera itself because it's a small device, as you can see. But then the troopers download it to a computer in the office. Anything like a citation or that nature is going to go to a court, we make a DVD, put it into evidence. All the rest of it goes onto a hard drive, and we store it for the time retention periods.
Okay. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Do the officers have an opportunity when they're stopping people and just checking them, or they think there might be a citation involved? Do they have a way of using a computer to know who they're dealing with sometimes? Do they have any real time? I mean, they're pretty isolated situations. Wi-Fi, everything's pretty well. I had experience up at the headwaters of Rogue 3 years ago. One of the officers just checking licenses in our boat, and he got to me, and he goes, looks up, looks down, he goes, "Oh, Senator Bates." And I don't know how he knew that, but he did. And I don't know if it was personal or he had some way of checking, but it would seem to me to have that technology would be something that would really help your officer. They're in some pretty isolated positions.
So co-chairs and Senator Bates. Like Patrol Division and also Captain Worthy talked about too, our technology, really that technology is across the Patrol Divisions, so in Fish and Wildlife as well. Mm-hmm. And so we have the tablets and also the old-style MDTs in our trucks. Yeah. And so we do have, as long as we have connectivity,
yeah.
So cell service so that we can actually be connected and get to those, then we are able to do some checks right. From the vehicle.
He did it from his boat. He had it.
So. I'm assuming that he might have just recognized you.
I don't think so. Well, I think he did after he saw me.
You hope not.
Yeah, everything was perfectly legal. We had a nice conversation, and he was a great guy. Great guy. We had a good time.
Great.
No problem.
Thank you. So the next three slides are our KPMs, and I'll go very fast through these. They're all related to our contacts with anglers and hunters. It's related to the number of people that we contact in those activities and then the number of those that are not in compliance with the rules or laws. And so we track that compliance rate. Our target is 90%, and on all three, one is for salmon and steelhead, this one we're at just 89%. This one is angler compliance for all fish species, and we're right at 89% again. And this one's for big game hunters, so for deer and elk and those types of things. And we're just about 89%. We are moving to two new proposed key performance measures, and what we'd like to do is increase our contacts with anglers and hunters because we think that that will help us provide some education factor with them. We will, by being there and making those contacts, we'll deter violations, and we'll also be around to actually detect and take care of the violations that we might observe while we're there. So. This is to achieve a 14% over a five-year rolling average, so we'll continue to increase over time. We'll monitor the 5 years and make adjustments to the target. Illegal harvest, or what's often termed poaching, is a problem in Oregon, and it's something that the Fish and Wildlife Division works hard at combating. And so this would be a measure so that we could track and work towards illegal harvest detection. So what that means is we're just wanting to increase our percentage of those of what we detect as illegal harvest, and we will get that from the public is very helpful to us, and also just what we detect by ourselves and go out and look for. Anytime we detect an unlawfully taken wildlife, or fish or wildlife, we're going to be trying to determine who took that unlawfully and make a case. However, the goal here is to increase and achieve a 22% increase on our legal harvest. And we're asking our troopers, and we do track each animal that we come upon. And in 2009, we asked them to even track better because what was happening was, like, if they're out on a, you know, in a marine environment on the dock, some crabbers, and they would check, maybe they had 20 undersized crab. They were taking a tick mark, a one, for a illegal harvest event, but we want them to take credit for the 20 illegally harvested crabs, if that makes sense. So that's the goal here. Two more slides. This is the governor's recommended budget for 15-17 for the Fish and Wildlife Division. We do have some diverse funding. It's $39 million, roughly, and our funding comes mostly from other funds, so that's really our contracts with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, with the Marine Board for boating safety, state parks, ATV work, it's 54%. Lottery funds provides 19% of our budget, and we do environmental work, commercial fish enforcement, just regular fish and wildlife enforcement. Federal funds in red, that's the federal agreements that we have with National Marine Fisheries Service to do federal fisheries work. It's really what that's about mostly. And then general fund. And the general fund in the governor's budget is increased from current. We're currently at about 7 to 8% general fund, and that general fund is an uptick in general fund based on Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. They're ending a 6-year budget cycle. They realized that in 15-17 there'll be about a $32 million gap. And so they have about 5 different strategies, and I think Senator Winters, you were asking about this yesterday. So one of their strategies is to try to maximize or utilize other funding sources to include the general fund. And they had a policy option package to ask for $5.18 million to come to the state police, which it is in the governor's recommended budget that it would come to us. And we're dependent on that coming to us, or it could mean, you know, the potential of affecting about 17 troopers. And
Representative Krieger.
Had a conversation with a man in this room who's kind of significant in your department, and it had to do with the subject we just talked about, dedicated funding source. You do not want to see the game division and the state police go to general fund in anybody's budget, because if you do, you're putting the whole agency at jeopardy again, and we're going to be dealing with the same thing with another 100 and some troopers. You need to keep it dedicated funding from the Fish and Wildlife, not general fund. You start down that track, you're not saving money in the long run. It's a dangerous precedent, and here again, if the job needs to be done, it's our job to make sure they get the funds.
Fair enough. And that's what that is what Superintendent Evans was talking about yesterday about that same thing.
Well, so. I wasn't here yesterday, but. Yes. if there was ever a place where the man was right, he's absolutely right.
Last slide. I just wanted to give you a brief on our budget drivers. So we have similar budget drivers as Captain Anderson was talking about, but one of ours is just having the money for capital equipment, trucks and boats. We have a fleet of boats, and it's not a large fleet, but we do have to have some boats to get out on the waters that we patrol. And our trucks are our mobile office for the Fish and Wildlife troopers. And really, the other budget driver is other funds, the uncertainty of fee-based revenue, like what we just talked about, and that $5.18 million.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Captain, I should have asked the patrol division, too, but do you get any equipment from the Department of Defense? Have you received any equipment from the Department of Defense?
So co-chairs and representatives, wasn't it? We, in Fish and Wildlife, I do want to mention that we always look for grant opportunities, in particular federal grant opportunities for equipment. And one thing I'll share with you is that this last biennium, we got a port security grant, a federal grant, and it provided $350,000 to the Fish and Wildlife Division. And what that money did for us is we were able to purchase and 2 new boats for the Columbia River, which is a pretty good-sized body of water and some rough water. And through that, we were able to also repurpose the 2 smaller boats that were in those same locations. So that money actually let us work with 4 different boats, you know, through that federal grant. I see that Captain Anderson's up here for Patrol Division.
Yeah, co-chairs, Representative Wisnett. Just quickly for the Patrol Division, we do not have any equipment from the Department of Defense.
Chairman. Thank you for, you know, because we've all looked at what's on TV and the concern about law enforcement officers using defense equipment, and we had any. But the state, Oregon State Police has no defense equipment that you're using for your SWAT teams or any of that.
Co-chairs, Representative Wisnett, yes, that's correct. At this time, we have no such equipment.
Thank you very much.
Representative Krieger, and then we're going to have to accelerate. We've got 7 groups we've got to get through in the next 45 minutes.
You've got a blue pickup there, which I think is great, dark blue, a little less conspicuous at night. I was forced to drive a white pickup around with canvas at night of camouflage trying to hide the damn thing. Mr. Superintendent and everybody, keep with the dark rig. Don't put them at a disadvantage where they stand out everywhere.
All right. Budget note.
What'd you know?
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next.
Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Patrick Ashmore. I'm the Deputy Superintendent of the Oregon State Police. I've been employed with the State Police for 27 and a half years. Of those, I have spent 13 years in the Criminal Division, but I hate to admit it to you today that I've been out of the division as long as I was in the division. So I'm going to represent the division today in their absence, and so I will do the best I can, but I'm going to try to go really fast as well for the sake of time. The Criminal Division provides investigations and assistance to OSP divisions, state agencies, and local law enforcement. The Criminal Division is an investigative arm of our agency. We routinely conduct specialized investigations in all 36 counties around the state. The detectives have established and maintained relationships with our law enforcement partners within their areas of responsibility. In many of our rural areas, our law enforcement partners do not have the means to provide specialized police services because they have prioritized their enforcement efforts essential to day-to-day operations, basically answering the call. That's where we help bridge the gap. We work very closely with our partners, and when there are a major crime committed, we combine our resources with the other agencies and have the ability to participate in specialized teams that have been formed throughout the state. These teams are referred to as the major crime teams, multidisciplinary teams, drug enforcement teams, and arson teams. I'm not going to read our priorities. You can just take a look at those, and I'll just go through my notes here real quick. The division is able to provide seasonal investigative experience in specialized areas such as polygraph, computer crime analysis, and arson. We also provide additional resources for immediate response to an investigation where there is a need to process a crime scene or a critical interview where evidence can be lost. There's been an increase to calls of service to child abuse investigation due to this, several of the financially stressed counties lacking resources. The division is responsible for all criminal investigations at state institutions such as DOC, OIA, and the Oregon State Hospital. Detectives are assigned to the drug task forces, working cooperatively to maximize capabilities and to avoid duplication. Our sex offender registration unit is responsible for maintaining all records and provides advice and assistance to local agencies along the way to provide court testimony. There are four statutory programs that the division is responsible for: Amber Alert, Missing Children's Clearinghouse, Homicide Tracking, and Unidentified Human Remains. Operational efficiencies and successes. The division responded to 120 statewide major crime cases in 2014. Major crime team callouts exhaust all agencies' resources, causing the investigation to be done in a collaborative manner and with our law enforcement partners, which is a good thing. We investigated 301 cases at the Oregon State Hospital in 2014, up from 199 in 2013. We do have a detective assigned to the Oregon State Hospital in Salem who has provided training to the hospital staff and to the patients. With that dedicated detective assigned to OSH, we have been able to effectively investigate the increased numbers of those incidents.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Winters.
I'd just like to say thank you because that was a joint effort with Walt Bigelow and the hospital and OSH and trying to get at some of the assaults that was happening in the frequent flyers, and as a result, and maybe the report should be shared with, I did share it with Senator Bates, but we've seen a decrease in the number of assaults, and we've seen a decrease in the number of workers' comp injuries. So I want to thank you for your involvement and the training that I know that all of you have been doing.
Thank you. So our sex offender registration is transitioning into real-time registration, making pending registration updates available online to our law enforcement agencies. A side note, 2 years ago as I sat in front of this committee, I recall that our backlog was a huge issue, and I just want to report to you today that we no longer have a SOR backlog. Our high-intensity drug trafficking area, HIT team. The HIT team is a highly trained group of detectives that are assigned to respond to roadside vehicle stops where criminal activity has been discovered. Due to their high level of training and access to sophisticated technology, they have been extremely successful in thwarting the transport of sales and illegal drugs in Oregon. The team has been recognized the last, or I'm not going to say the last 3 years, but out of the last 5 years, 3 years has been recognized by the Oregon HIDTA for their interdiction efforts. The key performance measure number 7, major crime teams investigation resolved within 12 months. This graph illustrates the percentage of major crime responses that were resolved within 12 months of the call-out date. A case is considered closed when the arrest occurs or an exceptional means such as the incident is determined to be an accident, suicide, or no crime was committed. The goal is to quickly and effectively investigate incidents and resolve violent person crimes. The target rate has been 93% since 2008. How are we doing? From 2009 through 2013, we averaged a 92.2% clearance rate. I did note, looking at the graph, that 2013 is not illustrated. I do know that it was 88%, so it dropped a little bit, but the 92.2% is reflective of that, so that's still accurate. KPM number 8, number of narcotics investigation assists per detective. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this KPM because we're going to propose that it be replaced. But as you can see, in 2013, our case assists were up 33. The reason we're going away from this KPM is because we are starting to put our efforts towards the drug trafficking organizations, which I'm going to talk about in the next KPM. Dismantle or disrupt drug trafficking organizations, DTOs, in HIDTA and non-HIDTA counties. This is the proposed key performance measure I want to talk to you about. A couple quick definitions. I've used the term HIDTA. It means a high-intensity drug trafficking area, which is designated by the Oregon HIDTA. A DTO is a drug trafficking organization, and I'm just going to read to you quickly the definition of from the National Drug Control Policy. Defines a DTO as an organization consisting of 5 or more person, 1, that has clearly defined the chain of command, and 2, whose principal activity is to generate income or acquire assets through a continuing series of illegal drug production, manufacturing, importation, transportation, and distribution activities. An organization is dismantled when its leadership, financial base, and supply network is incapable of operating and or is reconstituting itself. An organization is disrupted when the normal and effective operation of the organization is impeded, as indicated by the changes in the organization leadership and or changes in the methods of financing, transportation, distribution, communications, or drug production. I know that's a long definition, but we do get asked often what the DTO means, and that really is important for you to know. So on this graph, if you look, the listed DTOs in blue represent the HIDTA track DTOs reported by drug task forces with one of our detectives or supervisors assigned to that task force. The listed non-DTOs in yellow were reported through the current OSP drug form 100s, which are forms that we use internally. The goal of this KPM is to reduce the importation and distribution of illegal controlled substance. The strategy of this KPM is to provide services that support and augments the efforts of local, state, and federal task forces within the state. The factors affecting the result of this KPM are mid to upper level narcotic investigations focusing on DTOs tend to be longer in duration, while street level investigations tend to be short term. The type of investigation affects the time and the depth of the investigation, which could affect the number of DTOs disrupted or dismantled. You can see our 2014 numbers we're doing very well. So I'm not going to talk a lot about this graph. I just wanted to make sure that you saw the same thing you were talking about before. This criminal division is 80% general fund. I can't talk to you too much about the other funds, federal funds, there's grants, there's some other funding that I'm not familiar with, but if you have any questions, I can answer or get somebody to answer those for you. And the last slide is the division's budget drivers. The first one is increased calls for service in distressed counties. You can see on the right, I just demonstrate Josephine County. If you go back to the January 2012, that was prior to Josephine County falling into their financial distress situation. And you can see the immediate jump once we started taking the calls for criminal cases. So what this represents is years 2012, 13, and 14. And these are criminal cases. These are actually criminal calls that we take and have to investigate. So you can see that that is a budget driver for the division. The other one is 24/7 criminal investigation responses. Our detectives have to be available to respond after hours on the weekends, and obviously there's an overtime bill that goes with that. And the last driver is the complex criminal investigations that our folks get involved with when we have to deploy our resources from around the state to deal with a significant event. It is, again, a large bill that goes with that that we cannot anticipate. And that's all I have. If you have any questions, I will try to answer them.
All right. No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Moving right along. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, members of the committee. My name is Lieutenant Susan Horman. I'm here today representing the Oregon State Police Forensic Services Division. The purpose of the Forensic Services Division is to provide scientific support and technical forensic services to law enforcement, district attorneys, courts, and defendants in criminal cases. The OSP Forensic Division is the only full-service forensic laboratory system in the state, and we provide our services free of charge for the purpose of rendering assistance in criminal investigations and judicial proceedings. The division has several priorities that guide our decisions. First off, we strive to provide high-quality scientific results that can lead to the identification of suspects, but more importantly, the exclusion of persons thought to be a suspect in a criminal investigation. We conduct and or assist in crime scene processing, which is especially important to small agencies that do not have their own crime scene analysts within their agency. Our quality system is focused on providing high-quality analysis, testimony, and customer service to ensure we are responsive to the needs of the criminal justice system. And lastly, to facilitate the improvement in the quality of evidence that is being submitted to the Forensic Division, we provide training to the law enforcement agencies in the recognition, collection, and preservation of evidence. The division provides the services in the specialized disciplines that are listed on the screen. In 2014, we received 29,000 requests for our service. Operational efficiencies and successes. OSP is continually looking for efficiency improvements in our entire system. And in the Forensic Division, we are utilizing these efficiencies to add additional forensic analysis utilizing the existing staff without sacrificing the quality of our forensic analysis. In the past few years, the laboratories have made changes to their efficiency, and the increased efficiency and the judicious use of overtime have enabled the division to increase the number of our requests completed by 13% in 2014 compared to 2013. One of our successes has been the training to our criminal justice partners, which I listed before, and in January 1st, 2013 to December 2014, we provided external training more than 25 times to law enforcement, district attorneys, sexual assault nurses, and other groups. Another success has been the implementation of the DNA analysis by a high-throughput property crime program. We currently have 7 Oregon law enforcement agencies utilizing this program, and many more are requesting to be added. The program includes specialized training, specialized collection kits, and a streamlined process for analysis within the lab. Salem PD is one of the agencies utilizing this high-throughput property crime program, and from August 1, 2013 to August 1, 2014, Salem Police realized an overall Part 1 property crime reduction of 9.1%, and they believe that this is primarily due to the implementation of this program. I also want to inform the committee that in 13-15 legislative session, we received $1.4 million in the Senate Bill 5008 enhancement funds. And these funds were provided to us to buy additional forensic equipment and to add one forensic scientist. I want to thank you for that. And we have hired the forensic scientist and purchased all the designated equipment. With the exception of 2 toxicology instruments, which we are currently in the procurement process. The key performance measure you're looking at on screen is one that's going to be proposed for change. It currently is the average number of working days from when a request is received within the laboratory system until we have disseminated an analytical report. The numbers that are on the screen do not include the submissions for the postmortem toxicology program or the DNA convicted offender samples, which we also process. As you can see, we are not meeting the target of the 30-day turnaround time. This is in due part to the impact of a small number of cases with a high turnaround time. And when you're utilizing averages, those small numbers really adversely affect our turnaround. So we're proposing a change with similar language, but importantly different in that the percentage of analytical requests completed within 30 days or less. This is still an efficiency KPM, and our target is that by 2023 we have 80% of our analytical requests completed in 30 days or less. To reach this target will require a 3% increase in requests completed within 30 days for 10 years. The governor's recommended budget for the Forensic Services Division is $4.2 million. Of that, $37.7 million is general fund. I think of this as the cost to the Oregonians to ensure that they have a strong, efficient, and effective forensic laboratory system in the event that they are ever a victim of crime, and it costs them $9.41 per citizen for the 15-17 biennium. The other two funding sources are other funds and federal funds. Other funds are used to help with our breath tests testing instrument, and that fund comes from the breath test refusal allocations via the criminal fines and assessments. We also are continually looking for grant funding and utilize two National Institute of Justice grants. Currently, one is a DNA backlog reduction grant, which pays for two forensic scientists in the DNA unit, in addition to DNA training and overtime to reduce the DNA backlog. The other grant is a Coverdell grant, which is used to fund overtime for backlog in all other disciplines outside of DNA. With the budget provided, the division will maximize the use in an attempt to meet our goals.
Excuse me, Senator Bates.
Just real quick, how big is your DNA backlog? We've heard about this a couple sessions ago.
Our current DNA backlog in casework is a little over 1,000 cases.
What does that follow up? What does it represent in time?
Excuse me?
What does it represent in time? How long would it take you to get caught up?
I would have to calculate that and get back to you on that.
Thank you.
The budget drivers.
Representative Gorsuch. Oh,
excuse me. Co-Chair Shields, Representative Gorsuch.
To go back to the various services that are provided by this division, a while back there were some problems that were discussed related to question documents and the document inspectors. Has that been resolved?
Yes, we have dismantled that unit and are no longer providing question document services.
So where does that service go now?
They can send it to private question document examiners. There are forensic consultants that can do that work, and we do assist the agencies if they need to have that done in identifying a question document examiner.
And follow up.
I
also know that we have a national wildlife lab. Does OSP do any wildlife, or is it all sent over to the wildlife lab down in,
Ashland.
Yeah, Ashland.
Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, Representative Gorsuch. We currently do not do any fish and wildlife within OSP. The Fish and Wildlife Division, and the captain can address that question better.
All right, thank you.
Co-chairs and Representative Gorsuch, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Lab does not take state cases unless we're working with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which you do at times, but we contract our wildlife forensic work with Idaho Fish and Wildlife.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Williamson.
How do you manage updating your equipment? As I'm looking at this list of tests and the technology, I know on DNA testing alone is moving so quickly.
What do you with organs?
How do you manage that? And do you use contracted labs if you need a more advanced technology than we have?
Yeah, Representative Shields and Representative Williamson. We are always looking at the life cycle of the instrumentation and also at what is the technology improvements. So it's kind of a balance. If the technology is staying the same, is the life cycle of that needing to be replaced, and trying to look at least a biennium or two ahead in order to budget appropriately for the replacement of those. And, you know, if we need to change the technology at that time, then we will evaluate that as well.
So if you have a post-conviction DNA test, does that always get tested in your lab?
It actually usually does not get tested in our lab. They have the option in the statute to have us test it, and we're more than willing to do that testing. However, a lot of times the prosecution and whoever's representing the requester will make arrangements to have it tested by a private laboratory.
Thank you.
Okay, please proceed.
Quickly get to the budget drivers here. Our budget drivers are overtime, maintenance of accreditation of all five OSP forensic laboratories, our laboratory facilities, which are, as you probably know, more expensive than your basic office space and can be a large expense. And as a matter of fact, during this biennium, we are requesting through a policy option package to replace our Springfield facility and move them to a new location. The facility that they're in currently is crowded, and we no longer can add laboratory staff or instrumentation to that facility. Analytical supplies and instrumentation, as the number of requests go up, our consumable supplies and demand for instrumentation obviously is going up. And then the increase in the number of DNA analysis requests, in addition to the sexual assault kits that are pending and waiting for analysis, are budget drivers. And lastly, continuing education for our forensic scientists. In order for us to stay up with the technology improvements and continue to provide a high quality of work to the criminal justice system, you know, is necessary for us to have continuing education and to stay up on that. Thank you for your time and attention. Do you have any questions?
All right. I think we're good. Thank you very much. Next. Matt and Julie, how many more do we have to get through?
After this, you have one, two, three,
four. After Dr. Benson. Four after this, okay.
Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, and committee members, for the record, my name is Dr. Karen Gunson, and I'm your state medical examiner. I have been with the medical examiner's office for 30 years. I want to talk to you today about some of the samples about what we do in the medical examiner's office. We provide, of course, timely and professional service to the citizens of the state of Oregon. We are the sole source provider of all forensic pathology services here in the state by ORS 146, which is our medical examiner's law. We have 10 people in my division, so we're the smallest division of Oregon State Police. Six of those people are forensic pathologists, and five are our support staff. We provide postmortem examinations, of course, autopsies, examinations throughout the state, court testimony for anything that requires that, including, of course, homicides of all sorts. We spend a lot of time on the telephone with attorneys, with especially families, explaining to them why and how their loved ones have died. We also support the state and county child fatality review committees. I am the co-chair for the state child fatality review committee. Recently, we've been spending an awful lot of time worrying about mass fatality incidents, considering a Cascadia event, possibly, and so have been gearing up for with our partners for, heaven forbid, something like that happening to us. And I spend a lot of time, as do the other members of my office, training various law enforcement. This morning I spent 2 hours with the medical students and pathology resident at OHSU before I came here. We have certain priorities that are very important to us, and that includes the accurate and timely determination of cause and manner of death. To support this priority, we operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We do autopsies 7 days a week. So we want to get that job done the minute they show up at the door if we can. We also have the duty to identify 100% of our decedents. Now, that may seem like something that's easy, but not when it's a decomposition case or skeletal remains. So we have some new tools available to us through the federal government to help identify some of our unidentified decedents that we still have. We want to provide consistent and professional death investigation service throughout the state, and we have to partner with our county professional staffs to help us do that. The counties are responsible for local death investigation services, and we provide training and a week-long scenario-based class every year, plus ongoing training every month to those county programs. We do have some operational efficiencies and successes, I think, in the form of our collaboration with the Clackamas County Emergency Management, along with them and the Urban Area Security Initiative. We were able to acquire funds for a mobile morgue. It's the only mobile morgue west of Texas and has been utilized even in California for certain training events. We also are working on regional mass fatality teams so that we can be alert and ready if need be. We also partner with our forensic division in order to use their video equipment so that we can do video testimony around the state. Of course, that cuts down on the travel funds, but it also makes sure that we free up pathologists to do more cases rather than travel. We are 95% general fund, just under $5 million. We have other funds which include payments to us for doing autopsies for federal agencies like FAA, the FBI, and the Sheridan Penitentiary. We also receive small amounts of funds from Multnomah County, Clackamas County, and Washington County for utilizing our medical examiner office in the Clackamas area. Our budget drivers mostly include population. The more people we have, the more people die, the more people that fall under our jurisdiction. We have seen a sharp increase in prescription drug deaths, and so have been spending more time doing investigations of those cases. We also have that CSI effect where citizens can be sort of conspiracy oriented. So in order to answer their questions, we have seen an increased number of autopsies in those cases. We are actually the county medical examiner as well as being the state medical examiner for a number of counties, including Multnomah, Clackamas, Washington, Benton, Wheeler, Morrow, Columbia, and Lane and Douglas counties. So that means that we have some administrative duties in each one of those counties. That is the conclusion of my testimony. I am happy to answer any questions.
Senator Bates.
I'm sorry, real quick. These other counties, I used to be county medical examiner, by the way. You probably remember that, right? Sorry, I apologize. I'm a rookie. do you get paid by these counties that you're working for, that you're actually county medical examiner? I mean, how's the money flow between counties that do and don't use you as the county medical examiner?
Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, and Senator Bates, they do not pay us. These are counties where, especially, for instance, Wheeler County, there are no physicians present in Wheeler County, so they need somebody to sign their death certificates. And many of these counties have a robust county medical examiner's office with very good investigators who are 24/7. That would be Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas County. So they don't need a lot of help in this way, but they do need somebody to sign their death certificate. So we spend a lot of time on their particular cases. Mostly for Multnomah County, we provide the service of administration. We do not receive any funds from them.
I'll follow up off the record.
Okay.
I just don't understand the system and why some counties, the biggest counties, are getting services without paying for them, and smaller counties are doing it on their own. So we should have that conversation offline.
co-chairs and Senator Bates, I'm happy to have that conversation with you.
Thank you.
And colleagues, I don't want to discourage questions. If necessary, we can roll some more of this testimony over until Monday. So if you have a question, feel free to ask. Please continue. Is that it?
I'll go offline. You've got a lot of ground to cover. I want to talk about fees for various things. I used to do this, did it for 5 years, and I don't understand what you're telling us here. But let's have that conversation quiet, okay?
That'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Next, thank you for your testimony.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, members of the committee, Patricia Whitfield, Criminal Justice Information Services Division. The CJIS division is the state central repository for Oregon criminal history and law enforcement data, and we support law enforcement and the criminal justice community 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Our repository allows these agencies to store data, access it, and share and exchange information on a statewide basis. Not only does CJIS support the traditional law enforcement community, but also the regulatory and applicant community by doing a number of different background checks for various for various different types of regulated programs under state oversight, such as teachers and nurses and elder care providers. And there again, we are the sole source provider for those criminal justice information. Our priorities have a common theme: timeliness, accuracy, and availability of the records that we maintain and the services we provide, ensuring that our criminal justice partners have uninterrupted access to this law enforcement information is of course critical for keeping them safe and for the public. It's important that we know that an officer that's on the street running a criminal history can find out who it is that he has in his custody, and likewise the property that he's looking into, whether it's stolen or not. Real-time identifications and reporting of arrests and disposition records, that's the computerized criminal history and our ABIS automated biometric system. We use biometric fingerprints to identify the records within the criminal history file, and there isn't a record added until we ascertain that it belongs to the same person. Also, we're responsible for training and auditing all of our criminal justice partners and non-criminal justice partners through our LEDS training and audit area. They do many trainings and outreach to the user community to make sure that they know how to use the systems and tools at their hands, but also are accessing it, using that information appropriately. That is a huge issue for the data integrity and the trust of the public puts upon us for this data. Timely applicant and fingerprint background checks, and for firearms background checks. We always need to get those done sooner than later, and helping people to keep employed or be certified or licensed is an important part of that. We also need to make sure that while we definitely need to keep guns out of the hands of folks that are prohibited, we want to make sure those that aren't prohibited are able to do a transfer of that firearm as immediately as possible.
One moment. Representative Barker.
Thank you. So today as you may have known, if you came earlier, you would have surely known they had a hearing about background checks on the other side of the building. And so part of that bill says that if I'm going to sell a weapon to somebody, I have to go through to a dealer to do that. At the present time, I can call you and do it as an individual. Would it be much more difficult for it to be done by individuals rather than taking it to a gun dealer and having to pay an extra fee?
Co-chairs Representative Barker, currently, yes, individuals can voluntarily request checks from us, and I believe we did 153 of those checks, not at a gun show, last year. We certainly have the infrastructure for going through a dealer, so a matter of a few modifications to the software program to make that an option to essentially tell us that it's a private party.
So, but that wouldn't It wouldn't overload you, and it wouldn't be any different if I do it privately or if I go to a gun dealer. I mean, could you handle them both the same way, or would it cost the state police more money to do individual privately?
Co-chairs and Representative Barker, we do charge a $10 fee for all of the background checks. So it would essentially be whatever that volume ends up being.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
Representative Williamson.
In those background checks, what kind of information is asked for, and what do you do with the names after folks have either passed or not passed a background check for a firearm?
Co-Chair Shield and Co-Chair Williamson, we obtain the name and the date of birth and address of the person, and we also are required by law to do a weapons check, make sure it's not stolen. But the information is used to access a series of databases in order to make sure the person is not prohibited. And once they have been approved, then while the law allows us to retain that data for up to 5 years, or actually no more than 5 years, for anyone that's approved outright, there's no possibility that it'd be delayed later. Those records are purged after 10 days.
Thank you.
Senator Bates.
If you do a transfer, not transfer, if someone buys a gun from somebody else and it's gotten out through a dealership, how do you know that the person you do the background check is the actual one receiving the gun?
Co-chairs and Senator Bates, if I understand correctly, we are subject to whoever is on the other end of the phone or to let us know. There is in statute requirement that they have to be present, they have to show identification, and we do check the identification to make sure that the person information that they give to us matches something like a DMV record or that sort of information. But truly, we don't know. It is something that is on the obligation of the citizens.
Thank you.
Operational efficiencies and successes. Like everyone else in the department, we're constantly striving to find improvements and ways to do things better, quicker, faster. In the last couple of years, we combined two rather important services sections, identification services section and the law enforcement data system policy side into one CJIS division. That has offered us many opportunities for efficiencies, and it was largely a consideration for the House Bill 4131 and the oversight management to staff ratio. We've done several consolidations of workflow processes within all of our areas, which have resulted in good turnaround times, particularly for those background checks for our regulatory partners. System enhancements also have been just so critical to us, and we rely heavily on Captain Worthy and his crew in the information technology area to help us keep things running and operational. We implemented an electronic option for local courts to submit dispositions to us electronically rather than through the mail, and that's traditionally how it's been done. We have an electronic palm print system within our ABIS system, so it allows our forensics partners who are out there collecting crime scene evidence to actually be able to solve some crimes through palm print evidence, and of course not having to have a known suspect, but they can actually find the perpetrator through that kind of a check. We also implemented an online option for the firearms dealers, so they don't have to necessarily pick up the phone and call us, but they can initiate the check online. We have one key performance measure, and it served us well. It is the average turnaround time for an arrest fingerprint card coming into our operation, and it's from the point that we receive it to the point that it's posted on the criminal history. This has been significant over the years when we were really a manual process, and while we did 240,000 arrest fingerprints last year, there still were just under 4,700 that came to us in the mail. And while we would love to be able to reply to those on the same day, we have set a target of 4 days, and we've been meeting that and exceeding it, so we know that we need to adjust this, but it is still very important for us to maintain that eye on the prize. Our governor's budget, as you can see, we are largely other funded, and that's from those background check fees for services that we provide. That helps to offset some of the other costs. General fund being the next highest, we do receive general fund for some of the costs that the fees do not cover. And then federal funds, we have been fortunate to apply and receive NARIP, which is the NICS Act Improvement Records Program grant dollars to help us fill in some of the gaps for those records that have missing or incomplete information. Budget drivers, information, infrastructure and technology, of course, are very important to us, and it is costly to maintain these software and hardware and network infrastructures, but they are paramount to what we do. Largely CrimeView, which you heard of previously, which is essentially LEDs, the CCH file, wanted persons, stolen property. Customer needs and enhanced services. As there are new technologies and new initiatives that come about, we need to have those in place and have the ability to make them available to our criminal justice partners to keep them safe as well as the public.
Just one moment, Representative Krieger.
Can you just give me you had it up there a minute ago, but the background check brings in how much revenue, and then how much of that is actually needed to do the division performance? I know it goes beyond what it needs, and then I'd like to have a little more specific, where are those dollars going?
Co-chairs and Representative Krieger, be happy to give you a complete breakdown of, we have many different fees and many different programs, and while some are not enough to cover the cost, some are, but we do have a, our fee structure and our funding structure, those fees coming in do help offset the cost of the core services. So making sure that the criminal histories are up to date and that all of those records are available for all of those background checks. Okay. And then lastly, the changes impacting the services and programs. There are new programs and new functionality that are geared towards making changes to the things that we do. And there is a couple of bills that are being heard this session that are geared towards minimizing the number of background checks folks might have to have done, say if it's a school teacher. And so those things are, of course, a potential for impacting our budget since the largest part of our budget is other fund. That concludes my presentation. Are there questions?
Thank you very much. All right. Maybe time for one more, and then I think we'll probably end up rolling over some additional into Monday. And tomorrow we have public testimony on the OSP budget. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, I am Major Joel Lujan with the Oregon State Police and representing the Gaming and Employee Services Bureau. For today's presentation, I'm going to try to be as brief as possible, and I'm going to drill down to the Tribal Gaming Section's budget, specifically due to a request for reduction in FTE that was submitted by the Oregon Association of Indian Gaming Commissions. So the organization of the division includes the vendor investigation section, the lottery security section, tribal gaming section, and the Oregon State Athletic Commission. So what do we do? The vendor investigation section basically conducts in-depth background investigations for vendors wishing to conduct business with a lottery or with the tribal casinos across the state. The lottery security section serves as a security structure for the operation and administration of the Oregon State Lottery. And then the tribal gaming section through the Oregon State Police act on behalf of the governor's office under the tribal state compact to ensure that all class 3 gaming, which is casino style gaming, activities that are conducted with fairness, integrity, security, and honesty across the state. The Oregon State Athletic Commission regulates the promotion of all professional boxing, mixed martial arts, and entertainment wrestling events across the state. Our budget is a total other funds budget for a total of $10.4 million. The lottery security section through the contract with the lottery has a budget of $5.4 million. The Oregon State Athletic Commission with funds from 6% tax on gross sales, ticket sales, is supplemented by licensing fees for $284,000. And the vendor section through vendor fees has a $1.3 million budget. The tribal gaming section through a billing MOU between the tribes and the Oregon State Police is a $3.3 million budget. I'm going to skip a couple of these slides to get to the core and save on some time. The operational challenges for the division, as I mentioned earlier, there has been a request for the reduction of 2 FTE from the tribal gaming section. First of all, I want to lay down some of the groundwork. There is a billing memorandum of understanding that ensures that the tribes are not responsible for any of the associated costs. This is due to the reduction or the request for the reduction for the use of tribal gaming section resources outside of the gaming enforcement division. And again, OSP is committed to be a good partner and reciprocate any additional resources to the tribes during the time of need. There were 6 factors that were addressed in the request to the Oregon State Police. First of all was the regulatory cost of tribal gaming in Oregon. Under the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, specifically provides that gaming compacts can include an assessment as necessary to defray the cost of regulation. The cost of regulation for the tribal gaming section has remained relatively flat. I will have a slide that will represent that for the last 4 biennia, including the 15-17 biennia. The second factor was a recent closure of the Burns Paiute Old Camp Casino. In communications with the tribe, the Burns tribe still has intentions to reopen the casino. The closure of the casino is temporary due to the building structure and safety issues, and their compact is still active. The third factor was the assignment of tribal gaming personnel resources utilized outside of the tribal gaming specific job duties. What I can tell you is that there were a total of 93 hours in the 2011-13 biennia that were used outside. Now that includes training, special assignments, and other field work that's not related to specifically to tribal gaming. In the 2013-15, there were a total of 90 non-gaming hours that field agents utilized outside of tribal gaming specific duties for a total of 0.47 FTE for the biennium.
Could you tell us those numbers again on the hours, please?
Yes, sir. It was for the 2011-13, there were 93 hours for field agents, and for the 2013-15, a total of 90 hours for a total for each biennium of 0.47 FTE. The fourth factor was the underspent tribal gaming section budget. There were a number of reasons for that in the personnel budget. The first piece of it was due to the temporary hiring freeze during the 2011-13 biennium, and then also due to recruitment and retention challenges that we had during that time period. Since that time, we have been able to received an allowance from the Department of Administrative Services to increase our candidate pool by expanding the minimum requirements. If you can imagine, casino regulation is a niche industry, and to find a person with those specific skill sets is very, very, very difficult, especially when you're asking them to go to Pendleton or one of the field offices that we have. So by expanding our MQs, we went from recruitments of having 2 people available for application to pools of 60 applicants. Currently, all positions are filled. The fifth factor, reduction of workload demands. The state has regulatory work obligations per the Tribal State Compact. To meet these obligations, the workload is spread over the biennium as a way to address cost containment by and not adding FTE and operational cost efficiencies. In other words, instead of adding additional resources to try to cover the work in an annual basis, we've spread the work out and have aggressively looked for opportunities either through technology or just revisions of internal processes to become more effective at what we do.
Can I ask you a question about that last slide?
Yes, sir.
Can you explain to me what that last sentence means? Does that mean, why don't you explain it in your own words?
So one of the things that is in being a strong partner with the tribes is that we not only the specific gaming obligations that we have are billed for, but if there was a need at a casino for an active shooter situation where we would need to deploy a SWAT team or they needed special investigative assistance, those assets are available as long as there's no other legal reason why we can't deploy those assets. And when I talk about that, non-public law 280 tribes, Umatilla, Warm Springs, Burns, Paiute, it's a more of a challenge for us to be able to respond to those locations, but the remainder of the tribes are PL-280 tribes and would have that same benefit as any other public safety agency across the state.
Okay, so what you're saying is that while you won't pay the tribes back for shifting the staff, there's some complementary services that you will provide in the future.
And let me correct I failed to mention that the billing of those hours that are not tribal gaming hours have under the memorandum of billing does get credited back to the tribes.
Okay.
And has routinely.
Okay. Gotcha. Just to follow up for clarity, have situation arose where you need to do the reciprocating additional resources issue?
We have on occasion responded to public tribal lands for public safety services. Yes, ma'am.
And to where you've had to actually implement that particular challenge?
If I understand your question correctly, have we responded in a law enforcement capacity to a tribal casino? Yes, we have.
And how much are you near the end of your presentation, or should we bring you back on Monday?
I probably another 5-10 minutes.
Okay. Why don't we roll that over then to Monday? The co-chairs have to go to another meeting shortly. So we appreciate you and your testimony and the team. And tomorrow we have public testimony, and then we'll be back on Monday to finish up OSP.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, everybody.
We've heard nothing from anyone.
Everybody.
We've heard nothing from anyone.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.